You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.
Hello and welcome to this Times Higher Education issue review podcast for the edition covering the 29th of January to the 4th of February 2015, the 2188 THE for the record. My name is Chris Parr. I'm joined by Deputy News Editor John Morgan, reporter Jack Grove and freelance journalist Harriet Lyne. Nearly all universities in England have bounced back from the slump in student admissions seen after the £9,000 fees were introduced in 2012. And that's according to UCAS figures, and Jack will tell us a bit more about those in a second. King's College London reportedly dropped its hugely unpopular plan to become known as King's London last week. We asked Harriet to consider the do's and don'ts of university rebranding and find out whether it's really worth it at all. And academics work is often described in terms of teaching and research, but what are the other aspects of academic citizenship? Are these valuable activities being sidelined? John will answer that question for us towards the end of the podcast. But first, UCAS figures. After fees were increased, student admissions took a bit of a hit. But Jack, the latest figures suggest that numbers are bouncing back.
Yes, well, I've been having a look at the institution level data because everyone knows there was a record intake this year of 512,000 people overall entering university to do a degree. But I've been looking at which universities have been doing well, and the majority of universities took quite a big hit in 2012 when 9K fees came in. And this data I've been looking at shows that the vast majority of universities in England have recovered quite substantially.
Good news.
From 2012. Only a handful are still down on that numbers, which was seen as something of a low in recent times. And just looking at some of the universities that have done well this year, particularly post 92 universities, quite a lot of them have been recruiting in very high numbers, taking advantage of an additional 30,000 student places that were available. Only about half of those were filled, but it helped universities to offer more places and take more students and be a bit more generous with their offers. And so it's good to see that those universities are doing well. Lots of Russell Group universities that were hit quite hard in 2012, such as Birmingham and Liverpool, they're sort of back to their previous levels. So things are looking pretty okay at the moment.
Good news for the government. You'd think they can say, well, everyone had these warnings of disaster, recruitment would go through the floor if fees were trebled, and they can now point to these figures, presumably, and say, look, demand is as good as it ever was.
It is. That's true. I mean, it's interesting, though, that you see quite a lot of volatility in terms of students, universities recruiting, say, an extra 850 students this year or an extra 500 students. And in the past, things were a bit more stable, but student number controls meant that things were a bit more regulated. And it seems like the market is, things are quite volatile, and they'll probably get more volatile next year when student number controls are completely scrapped and it's sort of free for all. So it'd be interesting to see what happens then.
And where are they getting these students from? Because I know your piece makes the point that A-level numbers are broadly static. About 270,000 were accepted each year between 2008 and 2014. They're looking elsewhere, universities, at other qualifications that will gain admittance to universities.
Yeah, this is quite interesting. And Mary Kernock-Cook, the chief executive of UCAS, has been talking about this for a while. But the figures they released on an institution level really showed that all types of universities are taking BTEC students, holding vocational qualifications in quite serious numbers. So Aston University has tripled its intake of BTEC students in the past 6 years, as has Surrey and Kent, so sort of very well-established pre-92 universities. Also, University of Leeds takes more than 500 BTEC students, and the university to take the most is Manchester Metropolitan University. I suppose that's no surprise there. They take almost 3,000, so it just shows how important the BTEC is now for universities, and it was once seen as a bit of a sort of poor relation to the A levels, but actually universities seem quite happy to take on BTEC students nowadays.
Changing landscape. Not all good news, I should point out. Pam Tatlow, chief executive of the Million Plus Group, points out large rises in full-time acceptances at New University did not show the whole picture, as part-time numbers had fallen. So we've got time for discussing that piece, but if you look on page 6 and 7 this week and on timeshighereducation.co.uk, you can find all the analysis there. Now, when King's College London announced plans to drop the C from KCL and become simply King's London, there was uproar. Maybe I'm overstating that slightly, but our article on the subject leapt to the top of our most read chart, and social media discussion about the proposal went into overdrive. Harriet, you've been looking at what makes for a good rebrand off the back of that arguably poor one. Certainly, the sort of plans, the reported plan is to drop that rebrand. You identified some rules to which universities might stick if rebranding.
Yeah, well, I spoke to a couple of academics who specialise in marketing and branding, and they advised on the best elements of a rebrand. That including London in the name.
Yeah.
So they said it's becoming part of the Golden Triangle with Oxford and Cambridge, regardless of where that institution ranks, adding London tends to fool some of the international crowd.
Yeah, it's a track well trodden by airports as well.
Yeah.
If you've been out to Brunel University, you know it's quite a long way from the centre of London. It's a good hour and a bit.
Just like Luton Airport.
Yeah, well, South End, London, Luton.
Absolutely. Well, Thames Valley University became the University of West London. Middlesex and Kingston have also included London in their name. They also recommended imitating Hogwarts. So by seeming older, students are apparently more likely to apply.
Mm.
So on a lot of university websites, there are photographs of the oldest buildings, even if there's just one particularly noteworthy old building. And the website's pretty dominated by that. So that, again, is sort of imitating Oxbridge, but also Harry Potter, according to one of the academics. Students love the pedigree of a university, and so Latin mottos, coats of arms, and photographs of old buildings.
They might not quite like living in old buildings as much as they enjoy looking at them on websites. That's what happens.
Perhaps not. Also, Britishness sells. So St Andrews sort of capitalised on the Duke and Duchess of Cambridge. And also, if universities can't attract a royal to go to their university, then having a regal or British name tends to suffice, whether that's Nelson College or Imperial. And then they also advise making sure that everyone is on board, which is perhaps quite fundamental to avoid a Twitter backlash.
Yeah, petitions, tweets, angry emails, I noticed your piece talks about, and academics not slow to criticise if they think that something's being meddled with that they think should remain the same.
No, definitely not. But perhaps most fundamentally, the rebrand could just be a new coat of paint. So what they advised most of all was making sure that the research and teaching quality was up to scratch, and also checking that the university was pitching itself to the right market. So not just giving it a new look of paint. Maybe the problem is a bit more fundamental than just a rebrand.
Absolutely. Well, page 20 and 21 for that piece in full. Moving on to the cover feature this week. Thanks, Harriet. The cover feature looks at academic citizenship and asks, is it under strain? John, you co-wrote this with Chris Havergal, another of our reporters. He's not here, but you are. So, well, that question, is academic citizenship under strain?
According to the people we spoke to, several academics in British universities, that that does seem to be the case. So by academic citizenship, we would mean external examining, peer review, mentoring, the kinds of things that people might not necessarily see as being an automatic part of an academic's job, but which are integral to the scholarly world and the continuation of academic life. So spoke to Bruce McFarlane, who's Professor of Higher Education at the University of Hong Kong and author of a book on academic citizenship, and he expressed a worry that what academics do is too often split into teaching and research.
Yeah.
So those essential activities that we're talking about can be ignored, and increasingly academics in the UK work on teaching and research contracts. So where is the time and reward for those other academic citizenship activities, and also the research excellence framework very much rewards research, but what about those other activities as well?
You're saying we need a research excellence framework for all of these activities?
Well, I think from the people we spoke to, the levels of financial reward vary greatly, and some of these activities would be paid, some unpaid, some extremely poorly paid. External examining and PhD examining in particular was singled out for being pretty shoddily rewarded, maybe getting £150 for reading an 80,000 word PhD thesis and giving up a day to go and attend a Viva. But people were nevertheless extremely enthusiastic about the rewards that it brought for their own academic careers, and also the benefits for academic culture. And Susan Bassnett, who's a professor of comparative literature at Warwick, talked sort of very persuasively about the benefits of engaging with younger colleagues and sort of being involved in mentorship, saying that when she dies, "I don't give a toss if anyone continues to read my books, but I'd like to think that there are people somewhere who will remember me for having helped them at some stage in their careers."
Mm. And that presumably goes for students as well, things like pastoral support and caring for the student community, which obviously does have financial implications because students like to feel cared for.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's essential to the student experience is the buzz phrase, but where would students be without academics sacrificing their time to do things which they're not necessarily paid to do? Mm. There is another sort of counterpoint point of view, which is that academics have their contracts with their universities, and if they're doing external examining, that's kind of an extra income stream on top of that. No matter how poorly it might be rewarded, it is extra money on top of your contracted work. So one academic we spoke to said he'd heard this referred to as white-collar piracy, because you are, in effect, doing a bit of moonlighting, it could be said.
Interesting stuff. Well, page 34 for that enlightening feature. The second feature this week is Matthew Rice's interview with David Lodge, who has lovingly satirised campus life for years. He turns 80 and gives this interview, a very popular figure in the sector, certainly very well known. I'm sure that will go down very well. Also elsewhere in this week's issue, we reveal which for-profit colleges students are accessing nearly £96 million worth of student loan company funding. Former Archbishop of Canterbury, Rowan Williams, criticises the language used in higher education policy and the REF, and we have the latest on Labour's mooted tuition fee reforms. All that online as well. You'll also find us on Twitter, on Facebook, on LinkedIn and Google+, all the usual social media hangout places. Do get in touch if you want to comment on anything we've discussed, or indeed anything in this week's magazine. That's all for this week's Times Higher Education Issue Review Podcast.
You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.